Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Today on Change Surfer Radio, we'll be talking with Mark Blumberg. He's a behavioral neuroscientist and the author of Basic Instinct about the interplay of genes, hormones, and the environment in the creation of behavior. That'll be followed by a commentary by Michael Parenti about the medical profession. Stay tuned. Today on Change Surfer Radio, we're talking to Mark Blumberg. He's a professor of behavioral neuroscience at University of Iowa, and he's the author of Basic Instinct, which is about the influence of genes on our behavior. So do you buy the idea that there is a human nature which is manifesting itself somehow?
I wouldn't see it as a nature attempting to manifest itself. That question sort of brings out the very issue that I was trying to explore in the book, which is some essence or some creative force that's manipulating behind the scenes. As a developmentalist, as someone who is interested in how things actually come to be, whether it's across millions of years in the case of evolution, or minutes and seconds in the case of development, what we're really interested in is how do things actually evolve in time. And so when we think about things like complex human behavior, complex non-human animal behavior, we are trying to, our goal is to avoid those types of concepts that give us an easy answer and allow us to avoid the real intricate dynamic processes that give rise to these things.
So you're emphasizing the way that hormones and environment interact with genes to create basic instinct.
Yes. I mean, part of it is trying to understand what is an instinct. What does it actually mean to say an instinct, what an instinct is? And then there's the issue of where it comes from. And everything plays a role. I mean, of course, there are genetic factors, and they happen to be very, it's very popular today to talk about things in terms of genes causing things, genes manipulating, controlling, providing blueprints, programming. But these are all very misleading and very inaccurate, and many people would say false statements about what genes do. And so what we need to do is understand how genes are actually expressed, what are the factors that lead them to be expressed at different times, and how do all of the factors around the cell, within the cell, and around and within the organism, how do they cause organisms to change, and how do they how do we get out of that these behaviors that we call instinct?
When I was a psych undergraduate, we studied the Harlow monkey experiments, which were attempts to get at some of these issues about what was instinct and what was socialization. And they were experiments where monkeys had been separated from their mothers at birth and raised separately in cages and then reintroduced into their tribes later on. And they were found to not know very much about social interaction and to act quite psychotically. They would have a sex instinct, but they wouldn't know how to have sex because they hadn't observed it. Do you find those kinds of experiments compelling, or are they just a demonstration of a way that you can create psychosis and not actually show what was instinct and what is not instinct?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, I think that those types of experiments, for their time, they were very informative in that they pointed us in certain directions as to what, we should be looking for. I mean, what Harlow really showed was that early on in development, temperature is extremely important for newborn mammals, that they will cling to things that are warm. We know that to be true for rats as well. You don't have to show it in chimpanzees. I mean, actually, they weren't chimps, they were monkeys. But you don't have to show them in organisms like that. You can go to very, relatively, much smaller animals and animals that are easier to deal with in labs, like rats, and show many of the same things. And what you find over the process of socialization is that animals begin to make connections between thermal, warm stimuli and odors, and this process gives rise to very complex sort of attachment processes. And that's what we call, that's part of the process of socialization. And all of these things happening at the right time in development then give rise to, normal behaviors that we would call normal with respect to, functional things like being good at reproducing or being good at caring for your young. But all of these early developmental and physiological experiences at the right time of development are critical for giving rise to these normal developmental outcomes.
Well, let's take the instinct to reproduce. Animals have hardwired into themselves these instincts about how to go about reproduction.
Actually, no animals have hardwired genetic pathways for such thing. None. I mean, it isn't because the concepts themselves are misleading, because the real critical issue is that nothing is hardwired. Everything develops. And genes do not program anything. Genes are part of the process by which proteins are made, by which other genes are controlled. And that process is always dynamic, and it's always influenced by the local environment, and always influenced by the other proteins that are regulating gene activity. And this is true throughout life. So there are no hardwired, genetically programmed behaviors for any animals that have brains. Under normal developmental experiences, the same outcomes do arise more times than not, but that's not the same thing as saying that these things are hardwired or programmed.
So what do you make of this idea of human dignity or human distinctiveness, human exceptionalism, when actually what you are saying is that there's a great deal of continuity between human beings and animals in terms of their instincts and their personalities, their psychologies, their hormones, and so forth?
As a comparative psychologist, that is, someone who's interested in the commonalities and differences between different species, we're always on the lookout for those things that make us similar, and we're on the lookout for those things that make us different. And the differences typically reflect evolutionary differences, ecological differences that in the history of the animal. I don't draw a distinction between humans and other animals in terms of just us being animals. We do certain things very well. We do certain things not so well at all. You know, the common examples, I can't fly in the dark like a bat can. There are all sorts of things that bats can do that I'll never be able to imagine doing. We're fit for different types of things. Now, we have large brains. That is true. And now we have to ask ourselves, you know, why do we have such large brains? It's one of the great questions of human evolution. Some people see our large brains as just repositories for fixed instincts. There's no evidence for this. There's no reason to believe that that would be true. In fact, most of the evidence would be against such an idea. So, you know, our goal is to understand in any mammal, any animal, any, you know, vertebrate or invertebrate, insect, whatever, our goal is to understand these basic biological processes, because, you know, we learn a lot from understanding any animal and then comparing that animal to other related and not so related other species.
I'm speaking with Mark Blumberg. He's a professor at the University of Iowa and the author of Basic Instinct, The Genesis of Behavior. Let's take another case, Mark. The apparent drive that human beings have for sugar, salt, and fat. Many people think that because we were evolved to march around on the savanna looking for food, and nowadays we still have these basic impulses to eat and overeat certain kinds of foods, that we may have to re-engineer the brain or the body in order to overcome the plague of obesity that we're facing.
Yeah. It's a very important question. It's a very important issue. And the only way to really to resolve these questions is to more fully understand the mechanisms by which we metabolize these foods, taste them, you know, all of the things that are involved in the process of eating. And it's a very complicated process. It starts with some basic reflexes, and these reflexes are elaborated through experience. Just to give you sort of an example, one that I love to use with my students, they seem to understand it. When we walk past a candy machine, when I was a kid, candy machines were very simple things. You couldn't see a lot of the candy. And now you've got these glass cases with all of this stuff and all of these ways of stimulating us visually. And it's only through experience that we become attracted to these candy machines when we walk past them. And the process of seeing these things triggers these conditioned responses, like releasing saliva in our mouths or grumblings in our stomach or insulin release from our pancreas. And when these things happen, it actually induces us. The visual stimulus produces these conditioned responses. And then those conditioned responses really exacerbate our hunger. And those things in combination lead us to put the money in the machine and to take the food. Now, none of that is instinctive. The process of putting the money in the machine is not instinctive. We learn those things. And so we have to always keep in mind that from these basic physiological processes, there's always the adding on of learning and experience. And it's through that process that we really manipulate ourselves. So if we lose sight of that, we lose sight of a good chunk of our problem.
In this book, you also decided to take on the intelligent design debate. What led you to take up cudgels on that particular issue?
Just as someone who's interested in different species. Evolution is always a major issue. But I've also become interested in it because I see parallels between creationism as applied to evolutionary problems and the sort of creationism that gets applied when we're talking about genes and even when we're talking about minds. I see there's a common fallacy that connects all of these things together. I call it designer thinking. So, you know, when the problem that Darwin faced, people before Darwin, you know, saw these complicated things and they could only imagine that a designer, typically God, could have produced these complicated things, including us. Darwin provided us a mechanism to understand how complex things can arise through very natural, rule-bound processes. I would argue that the same thing happens when we talk about genes. We talk about genes as creative entities. We talk about them as programmers, as blueprints. We talk about them in all sorts of ways that I would maintain are parallel, analogous to the way we talk about the same mistake that we made in terms of creationism and evolution.
So we have a kind of animistic fallacy about the role of genetic evolution. I guess Dawkins would be an exemplar of that, his notion of the selfish gene.
He took a metaphor way out of the universe, of course made a bestseller out of it, so I'm sure he has no regrets. But, you know, he's still, I think that that is a fallacy that got, I mean, it's a metaphor that got out of his control. I don't know if he started really believing it, but I think in time it became such a popular idea that he was almost forced to.
So you want to counter that fallacy by emphasizing that there's no genetic intent involved.
Clearly no genetic intent. I think it's essential to take any, as you put, any animistic, any creative, any mentalistic ideas away from genes. Genes have none of those things. They are just molecules. What we can see, the structure comes from the history, and the structure comes from the entire embodiment of the genes within the cell, within the body, and within the local and more global environment. You take away any of those things and you do not have a functioning organism. You take away gravity, you take away the right temperature, and everything, all bets are off developmentally. Because the body, the organism, has come to, and I'm saying this in quotes, expect particular gravitational environments, oxygen, temperature, all of those things that are necessary in the process of normal development. Take away any of those things and you get grossly malformed organisms or organisms that simply do not survive at all.
One of the corollaries of the Christian right's belief that humanity is the result of intelligent design is that they are opposed to we intelligent designers, that is humanity, redesigning our own nature. And this argument's been taken up by critics of a variety of different kinds of bioengineering or psychoengineering projects. Given your examination of the bases of human instinct, are you skeptical also of the notion that we might be able to successfully re-engineer sleep or desires for sexuality or food or some of these other kinds of desires?
I'm not skeptical in principle. I'm skeptical that we're even close to being able to do those types of things. I mean, first, I think this discussion may indicate to your listeners, the notion of instinct is not particularly well defined. There are at least 8 different definitions of instinct that people use and often confuse in all sorts of ways. So we're not even really sure what instincts are. And we can talk about things and, you know, sort of assess them, but they're used in very different ways by different people. And then we're not really sure about how these complicated things, like behaviors, like language, like all the, you know, the very interesting things that humans do, and then all the other things that other animals do that are interesting for them, we don't really yet understand in the vast majority of cases how they come about. And so if you're going to fix a car, you have to understand the machinery. And we just don't yet fully understand the machinery. And moreover, we wouldn't know the consequences of tinkering in one particular group of people and living in one environment and how that might play out elsewhere. You know, the sickle cell gene, we think of that as being bad. It produces sickle cell anemia. Makes perfect sense in a malaria-ridden environment.
That's an often cited case, but is the conclusion of that we shouldn't engineer out sickle cell anemia because we might end up sometime back in a place where we might need that to ward off malaria?
Well, on that point, I agree with you. I mean, I think there is no, you know, a priori reason why we should prevent people from manipulating, you know, our biology. I mean, that is an ethical question, and I'm not, you know, I'm just a scientist. But I don't know why, at some fundamental level, why it is more ethically challenging to consider that type of biological manipulation as opposed to any type of environmental, you know, manipulation. Why is Head Start ethical, but any type of biological manipulation unethical. I don't really see that strong of a distinction, except for the fact that we may not understand all of the consequences of doing some of the things that we do. And I think that's really why some people are afraid. They're afraid we just don't yet have enough information to make really sound, you know, really smart, you know, decisions.
It's funny that you use the example of Head Start, because there is an enormous debate about the efficacy of Head Start. And from the right, there's the concern that Head Start and other forms of childcare is actually ethologically wrong, because it takes kids away from their mothers, and we're programmed to hang on to our mothers until 3 or 4 years of age.
Yeah, they did. And, you know, there are even some human groups that still maintain that type of bond. You know, the palmar reflex, where you stroke a child, an infant's palm, and you get that grasping response, that's an indication of our, you know, ancestral relatedness to animals that did cling. So we did do that, but we don't have fur anymore, but we still have that particular reflex. So one doesn't know what is essential and what isn't. You know, we know that some things work and some don't developmentally, but we don't know the full range of things that are tolerable for our species.
You seem to be a pretty staunch critic of human exceptionalism, and yet your lab was attacked by an animal rights terrorist organization. So what were you doing there?
My work is done with rodents, and they there's not much deep thinking going on in the animal rights movement about these types of things. And it is true that they might think that I'm a speciesist in terms of what I think about humans and other animals, but I'm not going to let their politics drive my thinking on this issue. I have, you know, very strong views about the relationships between humans and other animals. Why they attacked us, that's their motivation. They think that all animal research is unethical. They think that, you know, people who do this type of research, that we are monsters. And there's really no room for logical, rational debate with them.
I'm speaking with Mark Bloomberg. He's a professor at the University of Iowa and the author of Basic Instinct, The Genesis of Behavior, a book about the coevolution of genes, hormones, and the environment in producing what we think of as basic human drives. I mentioned earlier the prospect about eliminating sleep, and I've been a lifelong militant opponent of sleep. I know that that's probably to my detriment, and that many of the ways that people use to avoid sleep are actually quite unhealthy. But what can you tell us about the instinct to sleep?
Well, I study sleep, again, and in very, very young infants. And because sleep is something that we do mostly when we are young, I have been a strong proponent of the idea that we should be, you know, investing greater resources in understanding how sleep occurs in young animals, including humans. My theoretical take, my conceptual take, is that sleep must play an important role in the development of the nervous system, and it can do so in lots of ways. And it actually is directly related to our discussion earlier about genes, because you cannot produce a brain through programming. It has to develop. It has to develop from scratch every generation in every embryo. And so the process by which our brain develops, by which connections between neurons are made and then lost, the process by which we map, you know, our skin and muscles to particular parts of the brain in a very much a map-like way, all of that has to develop. And it develops in a way that occurs through what's called an activity-dependent process. In other words, we produce activity, and that activity sculpts the nervous system and its relationship to the body. And there are a number of us who now are very much interested in trying to understand how sleep can be playing a role in that process. So we need it. And the other issue of, can we engineer it out? Until we know what it does, you know, we really can't, you know, we would be foolish to get rid of it, even though it does take away, you know, 30% of our lives.
So what's next on your research agenda?
My research continues in the area of sleep, and I'm very interested in pursuing further these ideas about, you know, creationist thinking and how it affects the way we think about animal minds, about genetics, about human invention. But, you know, that's on the writing side and the thinking side, and I'm starting another book project as well. So, you know, I'm busy.
Let me run one last idea past you. I run with a crowd that likes to think about the future of the human race a lot, and one of the things that they like to think about is that eventually there may be, as the result of our evolution or the evolution of other species, some super intelligent race or species that would have the capacity to do quite monumental forms of engineering, including the engineering of new forms of life, which may actually be much more proximate than other kinds of engineering. And at any rate, I've been wondering with the intelligent design folks, because they try to make the argument that this isn't necessarily about trying to argue for the existence of God. And I've been wondering if you could say to them what their response would be. Okay, you find some evidence that you think is the evidence of intelligent design of human life or of life in general, but it actually may be some alien experiment in genetic engineering or the engineering of life.
In fact, you know, the intelligent design movement has attempted to sell the idea that, in fact, they're not committed to the notion of a God. They're just devoted to the notion of some creative intelligence. Okay, but the fact is that most of these people do come out of a very religious background and have gone to great lengths to hide their religious leanings because they're trying to keep this secular, at least for political purposes. The thing is that they've discovered nothing. The intelligent design folks have discovered nothing new, and their arguments are fallacious or just downright false. And about, you know, the way we are, the way we exist. We don't know, of course, how the universe began, but we do have some ideas about how life began on Earth, although, you know, we're still looking and still trying to figure things out. When it comes to human beings and our, you know, I just know how many things are wrong with me. Everybody can think of all the things that are wrong with them. And if you know, as I was saying once at a recent talk, I said, you know, if God had anything to do with the design of the human body, then you know, he's too engineering what Michael Brown is to hurricane relief. Because, you know, because, I mean, my back and my eyes and everything that's going wrong, you know, I just don't see a lot of real thoughtful, creative intelligence going on. And what's really interesting here is that, in fact, human invention, which is one of the great things that folks like to turn to as the example of what designing is like, I mean, Thomas Alva Edison was very clear that he never really designed things from scratch. He was always just simply doing trial and error, making mistakes, and learning from mistakes. And that's, in fact, how all inventions have occurred. So even their primary analogy to human invention doesn't work when you actually look how inventions arise. And there are engineers who have been writing about this very fact, very convincingly.
Well, Mark, it's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure for me, too.
I've been speaking with Mark Blumberg. He's the author of Basic Instinct, a book about how our behavior is shaped by the interplay of genes, hormones, and environment. Stay tuned for a commentary by Michael Parenti.
This is Radio Truth, a series of commentaries by Dr. Michael Parenti. Michael Parenti is an activist and internationally known award-winning author and scholar. His recent books include The Assassination of Julius Caesar and Super Patriotism. His latest book, The Culture Struggle, will be released in November 2005. For further information, please visit his website, michaelparenti.org.
Beware the doctors. What we call science is often something very unscientific. What gets funded and marketed as a scientific finding may have little to do with disinterested inquiry. For years, tobacco companies produced scientific studies proving that cigarettes were harmless. Oil interests still promote a handful of scientists who tell us that global warming isn't happening or isn't all that serious. The chemical industry sponsors scientific research demonstrating the supposedly benign nature of pesticides and herbicides. And pharmaceuticals have funded tests showing that various medications are perfectly safe when in fact they eventually have to be taken off the market as dangerous. Many established scientific opinions have been little more than embellished beliefs masquerading as objective findings. This seems especially true of the medical and psychiatric sciences. Thus, for centuries, in service to male supremacy and colonial domination, learned men in Western society produced supposedly scientific findings on the natural inferiority of women and the mental and moral deficiencies of the darker races and lower classes, the latter also referred to as the dangerous classes. Medical and psychiatric practitioners have treated illnesses by launching punishing assaults upon the stricken patients themselves. In earlier times, persons with serious physical complaints were bled, scalded, made to ingest sickening concoctions and burned with mercury. They had their fractured limbs amputated regularly or were subjected to all kinds of mutilating surgery, often with fatal results. Doctors spread lethal diseases by remaining steadfastly indifferent to minimal hygienic practices. During the early and mid-20th century, when tonsils became inflamed from resisting bodily infection, doctors would routinely solve the problem by surgically removing the tonsils, as if the organ were offending rather than defending the organism. If the stomach suffered from ulcers, rather than treating the cause of the ulcers, the stomach itself was surgically attacked, with its ulcerated portions being cut out. And by mid-century, hysterectomies became all the rage. Whenever fibroids, that is, benign tumors, formed on the uterus, the entire uterus would be removed, still a common practice. So today, gallbladders are routinely excised for doing their job of forming stones out of the impurities that accumulate in the body. For the last half century, cancer has been treated with a slash, burn, and poison strategy designed to destroy those body cells that have succumbed to the cancer pathogen while doing little for killing the pathogen itself. Meanwhile, alternative cancer treatments continue to be suppressed by the multi-billion-dollar cancer industry and their allies in the Food and Drug Administration. A close friend of mine was urged by her knife-happy physician to have her perfectly healthy ovaries removed because there was, he said, a 5% chance that cancer might develop. Persons judged to be mentally disturbed were similarly attacked, incarcerated, often for a lifetime, verbally abused, beaten, bound, gagged, starved, isolated, and drugged. Among the illnesses treated during the 19th and early 20th centuries were nymphomania, masturbatory insanity, and disruptive behavior of almost any sort. Psychiatrists and physicians long believed that hysteria was a malady caused by disturbances in the uterus, hence an exclusively female disease to be cured by removing the ovaries of insane women. More recently, mental patients have been heavily medicated, electrically shocked, or lobotomized. The troubled brain is treated as the troublesome brain, as if the victims themselves were the problem rather than their illness. Most of the patients so treated are in public asylums and are mostly from low-income groups. Beware the doctors. They frequently think they know more than they do. This is Michael Parenti for Radio Truth.
This commentary was produced by the LA Sound Posse and may be freely copied and distributed. You can find us on the web at lasoundposse.org.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts with me, Dr. J, you can contact me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Or you can read my Change Surfing columns at betterhumans.com or check out the collaborative Cyborg Democracy blog I participate in at cyborgdemocracy.net. Or you can read my new book, Citizen Cyborg. For more details about Citizen Cyborg, visit cyborgdemocracy.net. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the AInfos radio project. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.